Hi, my name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off-Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who go or don't go to church, and where we can meet and hear from those that have made their faith count. This podcast series is to encourage via conversation and not necessarily change your mind prior to listening. You can contact us as well by email, ogc@accessradio.biz, business spelled B-I-Z. Please use this address as we are starting a mailing list, which will then keep you informed of all the upcoming episodes and lots more. The address again, ogc@accessradio.biz. So please enjoy today's guest, who lives in Melbourne, Australia, and he has been in Christian ministry for well over 30 years. He has been a program director at Teen Challenge, a lecturer for Bible College, an executive director at Youth for Christ Melbourne, a multi-site church executive pastor, and recently project development manager at Alpha Australia. Our guest has been involved in church leadership training and community development programs in many countries outside of Australia, including Cambodia, Kenya, Mauritius, Serbia, and Poland. His early life included running away from home and then living on the streets. Perhaps this could be a reason why one person wrote that he is phenomenal on creating healthy marriages. So, what is a healthy marriage? Why did he run away from home? What was it like living on the streets? What has he seen in all his years of Christian ministry that encourages him about the state of the church in Oz and further afield today? What has he seen about the youth of today and their thoughts on being or becoming a Christian? What from his experiences to date would he do differently if he had a chance to revisit previous events? All these questions. Better go and meet our guest then. Gives me great pleasure to welcome to Off-Grid Christianity, Greg Murray. Greg, thank you so much for joining us this evening. You are in Melbourne, Australia. What's the time there currently, sir?
It's 7 a.m. in the morning, and it's our winter, so it's still dark.
But warm dark, I would have thought.
No. It's probably about 6 degrees Celsius.
And if people are saying, well, we know Melbourne is Australia. Aha! If you live in Derbyshire, you know there's a Melbourne just outside Derby.
Yeah, and there's a Melbourne in Florida, USA as well.
Oh, is there? Have you been to that one?
No, but I do. I have a relative that accidentally booked an air ticket thinking he was coming to Melbourne, Australia, to Melbourne, Florida.
Oh, no. So what happened?
He realised beforehand, thank goodness, but he did actually book it.
Oh dear. I think it's going to be a cracking podcast. I'm looking forward to this immensely. So let's go with the five questions then first, if that's right, Greg. Fingers on the buzzers, no conferring. Question one, if you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask them questions, who would it be?
I would like to have dinner with Alfred Hitchcock.
Oh, really? Great answer.
I love movies and he's quite innovative for his day. And I mean, I know people know him for some of the more scary films, but he did make some other classics like The Trouble with Harry, which is a comedy of a dead body that keeps for going missing. And yeah, no, I like movies. They're parabolic, really, so I wouldn't mind having dinner with him.
Well, in that case then, first of all, what meal would you cook him? And secondly, what kind of questions would you ask him?
Oh, I would definitely ask him around some of his direction choices. He really invented some new shots in filming and movies. Yeah, just some of the ways that he would develop his scripts, like the 39 Steps, for example, which is still one of the great classic mm-hmm. films. What would I cook him? I used to be a chef, so I don't know whether he'd want a traditional English meal or I was French trained, so maybe something French.
Oh, just sort of stinkin' pine chips, really, I think he'd like.
Probably. That's right. That's probably right. I wouldn't cook him anything with birds in it. Let's just say that.
Oh, very good. Don't tell me what happened because last week our son, who likes watching films, he hadn't ever seen a Hitchcock film, and I'd never seen Vertigo.
Oh, great. That is right up there. Yeah. Vertigo and Rear Window are probably one of my two favourites. Yeah.
Rear Window with Julie Andrews, that Rear Window.
Jimmy Stewart and Grace Kelly.
I think you're Torn Curtain, aren't I think?
Yeah, yeah. And Raymond Burr is the bad guy in Rear Window. Rear Window is just a great film. It's about a guy who's got a broken leg and he thinks he witnesses a murder in the apartment opposite him. But he can't prove.
Yeah, we can't prove. Can I just say, I thought Vertigo was amazing. And that was going to be a question for you, actually. Name the film that the BFI Institute, British Film Institute, in 2016, I think, or 2012, nominated as the greatest film ever.
When I first saw Vertigo at the end, I didn't know whether to laugh or cry.
You're right.
It just sort of ends pretty abruptly.
So we had the 4K version on a disc last week. And actually, they did an alternate ending.
Yeah, which is very common in filmmaking. Very common.
This was for the European market. It was a bolt-on to say what happened next. That was all. Yes, a cracking answer. Yeah. I don't think anyone's ever chosen that before. So, yes, you'll have great fun. Question two, then. Who is your favourite biblical character or favourite biblical story or favourite parable, please, Greg?
Look, that changes, to be honest. At the moment, I've been reading through Numbers, and there are five unmarried sisters that change God's mind in Numbers 27.
What?
And it's just really stuck with me. Rereading it, meditating, reading commentaries on it. I think often stories involving women get overlooked in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Very quickly, the stories around them divvying up the promised land before they've entered it. And, of course, Numbers gets its name from two censuses that are taken within the book. So this is following the second census. And, of course, they're going to divide up the land according to clans, but these five unmarried sisters have no father. He's died. No brothers, no uncles.
Yeah.
And so they're not going to get any land. And they complain. And God actually says to Moses, they're right, which is, again, a great phrase. How many times does when you complain to God that he says, no, you're right? And so he changes the whole, what really became a systematic law in divvying up the land because of them raising the sense of injustice. So that's one of my current favourite stories.
Wow. Well, can I just say, that's never been chosen before either. So you're on an absolute roll on here. That's absolutely brilliant. Can I just say, as a quick plug, around about episode 70, 71, something like that, I think, with Jeannie Kendall, Baptist minister, we looked at the ladies in the Gospels. You know, what was Jesus saying? How did they help and everything else like that? Fantastic episode, he says humbly, if you'd like to have a listen to that one. And then we did a sequel a few weeks later after that about why Paul championed women in the Bible. So, you know, we're trying to dispel a lot of rumours and stories on that as well.
That's right.
Jeannie did.
That's good.
Not me. I never went to theological college. Couldn't have coped. Question three. If you were Prime Minister in Australia, because you have Prime Minister down there, if you were Prime Minister for the day and could change any law or impose a new law, what would it be, please, Greg?
I think it would be wise for us to teach relationship skills in schools as part of a school curriculum. Focus very much on what we think is education, like, you know, maths and science and, you know, language, English. But, of course, relationships affect every part of a person's life. Forever. So whether they're building a career, whether they're falling in love or, you know, building a family. And yet we see so much dysfunction and breakdown in families, at workplaces. That's always puzzled me as an adult, why that is not taught. So things like forgiveness, communication skills, why we don't teach basic relationship skills as a matter of course. Because many people in schools, of course, come from dysfunctional or broken families, and so those schools don't exist. They're not modelled to them. So I think that's one thing I would tackle if I was Prime Minister.
Well, that's brilliant. You are also allowed a flippant answer as well.
I don't know if I have a flippant answer, actually. I'm not really a big political egghead, so, you know.
A silly one, then. You can have a silly one. That's what I meant.
Maybe give out free chocolate for a day. As I say, there's only five main food groups. There's hot chocolate, dark chocolate, milk chocolate, white chocolate, and Rocky Road. Chocolate's a very important part of an overall diet.
Cracking answer. Thank you very much, Dee. Unfortunately, I'm pretty sure only, a couple of months ago, someone actually chose relationship training in schools. So you've let the side down. You could have gone for a hat trick.
I could have, yeah.
Yeah, you have to try harder, Greg.
Next time.
See, I get one question for you. Outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out to date, please?
Look, one thing I really always wanted to do and finally got to do it was hot air ballooning over Melbourne. So Melbourne's one of the few cities where I live that you can actually do it in the city. So you literally, depending on where the wind's blowing in the morning, we literally skirted the CBD of Melbourne, Victoria, here in Australia.
CBD? Sorry, what's that?
The Central Business District, so downtown, High Street. Went near next to the MCG, flew over that.
I know that.
Yeah, of course you would.
Melbourne Cricket Club, for those who don't know.
And we actually landed in Albert Park Lake, which is, for those listening, is where the F1 Formula One Grand Prix is held every year.
All right, yes.
Yeah, so that, and we had a picture-perfect morning. There was not a cloud in the sky. The sun came up. It was a very, not too windy. So we, you know, it was just beautiful. So That was probably one of the most spectacular things I've ever done, is go up in a hot air balloon.
Did you think of jumping over with a bungee rope tied to you?
In my younger years, I probably would have. But no, I was happy just to have a bird's eye view of the city I live in.
Yeah, that's a cracking thing to do. Love it. Question 5. What has been your most embarrassing moment to date, please, Greg?
Well, it actually happened recently. I flew from Melbourne to Sydney, which is, you know, just on an hour for work. I have a very unusual coloured suitcase. It's sort of a bluey green. And, of course, you know, a lot of suitcases are black or grey. And yeah. I took the wrong suitcase and I was like 15, 20 minutes away from the airport. And the airline's trying to ring me. I didn't recognise the number. So, first, I didn't pick it up. And not knowing, obviously, that I had the wrong suitcase. And it's never happened before. We had a hire car. Sydney's doing some redevelopment at the airport. So, the hire car place is out of the airport. So it's a bit tricky to get to by bus. You know, it was a real drama trying to get back. You can't leave your car, obviously, in front of an airport to bring a bag that you stole accidentally. And the poor couple, by the time I got back, it was probably like 45 minutes after I'd left the airport. I was so apologetic and embarrassed. And they'd come to Sydney for some medical treatment. Oh, and, you know, I delayed them. They were so gracious to me. So now I literally triple check my bag every time I travel somewhere, just in case.
And yet I think this is an Alfred Hitchcock film, isn't it? Something like that happens at the beginning.
Yeah, oh, sure. Yeah, that's popping. Or Ronan's one of those films where you never know what's in the bag, but the whole film's about stealing that briefcase. So
if only it happened like 30, 40 years ago, or a bit less than that sort of thing, and you could say, and that's how I met my wife.
No, it wasn't one of those stories, unfortunately, but I just felt terrible. I was so apologetic, you know, wanted to beg their forgiveness, but they were very gracious. They said, look, we understand, it's all right. Yeah, no, I felt very embarrassed about that.
Cracking story, mind. So thank you for sharing it. Thank you. That's one of the top 10 ones, that is. Well, Greg, where should we start from, do you think? I know. Let's go to one of the things I said at the beginning, if that's all right. I talked about your early life. I said it included running away from home and then living on the streets. Now, that could be just a little blasé thing, but it's not meant to be. So tell me more what happened, please.
I grew up in a family really not knowing my father at all. So I have no memory of him. And so there were four of us in the home with my mother. And I sort of didn't really get along with my mum as a child. I was struggling at school in the very early years. I couldn't read or write. You know, I was just trying to probably escape and look for some other life somewhere. That was sort of my sort of thoughts as a young child. Often I would run away from home and try and find somewhere else to live. I'd often get picked up by the police. And in the end, they put me into a boys' home, you know, actually here in Melbourne. From memory, I think I went in there twice overall. You know, that was my early childhood, was quite unhappy, pretty sort of dysfunctional family life, and just didn't know what my future was going to be. So when I was probably, I'm trying to think of the exact age, I was probably about 11. Mm-hmm. And I think it was the second time I went into the boys' home. I remember one of the other boys telling me his story, that his mother didn't want him, and he was living with his grandmother, who he didn't get along with and was quite angry. And so he would walk down to the local shop and pick up a rock, throw it through the window of the shop to smash it, and just wait for the police to pick him up. And I thought, man, I've got to do something about my life, because that's how I was feeling. I wasn't doing the same thing. And so I'd already had an encounter with God as a young child, actually, in a church. And so that sort of sat with me. And it was at that sort of moment that I thought, I have to actually start doing some things differently, or I'll end up probably just in prison. You know, very dysfunctional, very unhappy, and trying to avoid life at any cost. But, you know, that moment was pivotal for me. I thought, okay, if God's there, I need to take him seriously. But yeah, they were my early years as a child.
What was your encounter with God then, as a young boy?
So I think when my parents first split up, so I probably would have been about 4, maybe even 3. My mother started going to a church, I think invited by a friend. Obviously, she was quite broken and devastated by what had happened, and it was a Pentecostal church, and they sort of offered to do baptisms, so, you know, full immersion water baptisms. And I think by the time I was about five or six, I was just had some response within me to actually want to do that. You know, eventually I got water baptized in that church as a child. And that really stuck with me, that experience of actually being water baptized and coming up out of the water speaking in another tongue as like a six-year-old. So I sort of had these two extremes. You know, I had a very, like looking back now, a dysfunctional and unhappy childhood, but also I had this experience with God that made it a reality for me in the midst of all that pain and dysfunction.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Also said as well that you were living on the streets.
Well, just trying to survive, you know, just, you know, obviously when you run away from home as a young kid, as a 10 or 12-year-old, you're just trying to survive. So, you know, would break into cars or homes trying to find some coin to just feed myself, that sort of thing. I didn't really live on the streets for long stretches. It was just over a couple of nights each time, really.
Yeah, but even so, you did it. The turnabout then, what do you remember that time when you thought, right, that's it. I'm really going to sort of chuck all this in. I want to go straight.
It probably was just God speaking to me, like looking back now, but just that sort of tenacity to say, I may not like my current circumstances. You know, I'm imperfect as well. You know, don't blame everybody else all the time. But actually take responsibility and build a better life, actually develop a better life. Mm-hmm. And so a couple of things happened around the same sort of time. My older brother had already left home sometime before this moment. And coincidentally, maybe, I bumped into him in town one day. He said, oh, come and live with us. He was sharing a house with some guys who are all going to this particular church in Melbourne. And so I ended up there, long story short, I ended up sharing the house with a group of guys and started going to church, which was a church that really took an interest in teenagers. So they would run sessions on just for the young adults and teenagers, and things like personal hygiene and safety. Mm. And so not just biblical subjects, but actually practical living subjects. So it was pretty unique in that way. And so that really helped me to say, okay, there is a bit of hope and I can apply some of these principles to my life and change the direction of where my life was going.
And of course, back at home, your mum and your absent father, what did they think what was going on with you at the time?
Look, I was probably a bit of a rebel. So for my mum in particular, you know, she sort of knew where I was and she knew the a couple of the leaders at the church and stuff like that. So it's not as if she didn't know, you know, what was happening and things like that. My dad, he'd left. So I literally never had any contact with him, even to this day. He's now deceased, but never reached out to us, not once, ever. So I've no memory, no conversation with him. For me personally, that wasn't so bad. It was probably dealing with some of the other stuff between me and my mother that I had to work through myself personally.
And no doubt we'll talk more about that later on, because on a previous podcast, we were talking about conflict resolution and saying just how important it is to have that and to talk and discuss.
Yeah.
So without giving too much of the game away as to what actually happened, you know, what did actually happen in the end between yourself and your mum?
Yeah, my mum and I get along really well now. I think it was more around me changing. So, you know, everyone listening will have a story of where they've tried to help somebody or think that the other person needs to change. And there might be some truth to that. But, of course, we all learn, I think, at some point in our life, you can't change anyone else but yourself. And so one of my sort of core values is what attracted me to Christianity was I really wanted to be like I thought Jesus was very cool, but at the time the Christians I knew weren't that cool. So, you know, I was one of these very young, probably at the time maybe 15, but, you know, I wanted to follow Jesus, but I didn't want to be like all the Christians I knew.
Yes.
The reason I'm saying that, it was more around I knew I had to do something about myself, so I couldn't change whether it's my mum or anybody else. I can't change anyone else. But I could be different. My reactions, my responses, I could act a bit more in love and grace and mercy. We all don't like suffering injustice or what we think is injustice. But of course we all do experience it. So for me, it was more focusing on my interactions with my family and being more like Jesus in the way I did it, regardless of whether I felt they were in the right or wrong, or, you know, they didn't deserve it. I had to deal with my own internal thoughts and feelings to make them more like the way Jesus would interact. And again, that you have to remember, that was because my focus was I needed the help. That's what attracted me to Christianity, is I was sort of living in hell now. I didn't become a Christian to escape something in the afterlife. I needed God to help me right now. I think that's my focus, and still is really today, is I need to work on myself and develop myself and become the type of person that I think Jesus wants me to be.
If we go back in my time machine to when you were working this through,
yep.
What did you think Jesus wanted you to be all those years ago?
I think what Jesus wanted me to be was someone who matured. So again, another life value I have is, I think in Christianity, happiness is not the goal. Sometimes I think the gospel's presented that way, but really maturity is the goal. So as a young teenager, when I sort of made this new wholehearted commitment towards God as a teenager, I sat down and started to read every passage I could find on being a father and a husband.
Wow.
And again, because I didn't have a role model at all on any of those issues, my dad being totally absent. And again, I was intentional. I knew I needed, I thought, if I ever get married, what sort of father and husband would I be? That was one of my first real focuses. And I spent years, not just a, you know, a couple of weeks or a few months, years discovering every Bible passage on whether it was direct or indirect. So whether it was a narrative or a direct command on what a husband and father should be. And I was going to try and live that out. And I was asking God to help change me, that I could stop part of my family of origin, their history of relationship breakdown. But that's part of my personality, Martin. You know, I sort of feel I'm a bit of a dog, you know, with a bone. If I get a focus, I'm going to stick at it. I know it's not going to be easy. You know, Christianity is not an escape pod for difficulties of life. In my head, you got two choices. You can either live life without God or with God. Both have challenges and pain and suffering and difficulties, injustices. But at least with God, he helps you to respond in a very different way and process stuff in a different way. So, yeah, I was quite intentional about doing that. In fact, I used to, in my early years, I worked in a bakery. I used to have to start at 4 a.m. in the morning. There's a tram system here in Melbourne. So from where I lived to where I worked, I'd get one of the first trams in the morning. And on the way home back, I'd get off the tram in the city centre, and there was a church, you know, St. Paul's is the Anglican Cathedral here in Melbourne. I'd go in there and sit and pray and read some of the Bible. So this is early afternoon when I'd finish work before I went home. But all the focus on, okay, God, if I have a family, I don't want to repeat the same issues. And so I'd better start working on it now, even as a teenager.
That's a very mature thing to do. I don't think many people would come up with that. You must have had some weird looks, I would have thought.
I just, you know, for my, maybe it's my personality or my, just my commitment, I thought, well, if I really want to change the destiny of my life and then my, if I had got married, which I eventually did, but my future family, then I have to be responsible. And God has said a lot about those subjects. And so I was trying to eat the word of God and let it, you know, like when you eat a meal and it, every part of the meal actually permeates your body. I was trying to digest the learnings from bad fathers in the Bible, bad husbands in the Bible, as well as good ones. You know, we have some pretty bad stories because they teach us what not to do, as well as very good stories that teach us what to do. The word I use is I'm intentional. I'm quite intentional. And years later, I'm now 59, got three children, adult children, one grandchild. I think I've done pretty well, you know. My wife Sue and I are very happy together after we're about to hit 38 years in a month's time.
Wow.
And so I've broken the family trend. I mean, no one else in my family's done that. But I don't say that arrogantly.
No.
I just knew I needed help, and I knew what the pain was like as a child with no father. and a dysfunctional home life. And so I was going to do everything I can to change that. But I knew I needed God's help. I also knew I couldn't do it on my own. And I don't treat God as some magic genie in the sky. You know, there's a long ancient history of learnings, writings that, you know, obviously we call the scriptures. And they're there for a reason. Humans have guarded, protected, copied, and transmitted them to other generations because of the wisdom that's in them. Again, that's probably just part of my personality of being very intentional. I knew I needed to grow up, which is the word of mature, right? I needed to grow up. And so that sort of quickly, you know, very quickly, bit of my life story in a nutshell.
Well, that's an amazing story. Going back to that time when you were like 18, 19, 20, and literally realised that Sue would be just round the corner, and I'm guessing you got married at 21, something like that, if my math is correct.
I did get married at 21, yeah. My own family history stuff didn't put me off in a way. I just thought, if I'm going to do it, I want to have children while still young enough. So I know the current trend is to wait, but I didn't want to sort of be an older father with young children. We both decided to get married. I have no regrets of getting married at 21.
That does help, doesn't it? If both of you deserve.
That's very, very helpful. Yeah, so I've no regrets at getting married young. I think some people think that, you know, when they come from a background either similar to mine or another story of parents not staying together or even living in a very unhappy home where the parents stay together but they're not emotionally connected, they're at each other or they're arguing, there's a lot of disharmony in the family home. It puts people off. But look, for some strange reason, it didn't put me off. I just thought, well, I'm not going to do it that way. I don't know how on earth I'm going to figure it out, but I'm going to have a crack and I'm going to ask God to help me. That was sort of my baseline. I think people think that a good marriage is by chance, but my experience, actually, it's not. A good marriage is by choice. And both people in the relationship have to continually choose to build a culture of nurture and appreciation. You know, even if you're really mad or upset or under a lot of pressure, you know, there's a whole lot of things. Your family of origin stuff comes out of you automatically. You know, we have a little funny phrase that I say, sometimes I open my mouth and my mother comes out.
It's true, though. It's true, yeah.
It is very true. But I use the phrase, you build a good relationship. You don't have to repeat the crisis or trauma or mistakes that often generationally get passed in a relationship, but you do have to be very humble and intentional to build a healthy relationship. The great thing is, jumping ahead a little bit, but when I went to Bible college, I was working for Teen Challenge at the time, running a drug rehab, and I thought I'd better get some qualifications around it. But what really helped me there personally is we had to do a family and marriage unit as part of the study. And a lot of the scientific research was just coming out about how relationships last a lifetime. So some people may have heard of John Gottman, a US researcher. I had to study his scientific research. So they literally filmed the same, I think around 3,000 couples over 30 years living in an apartment, sort of set up like the Big Brother house, you know, double-sided windows. They were filming the couples, taking their urine samples to test their stress levels. They're wearing heart monitors. Like, this is a proper scientific long study.
Okay.
And they'd ask the couples to have a discussion. They'd live there for 2 days and say, look, during the 2 days, just discuss something that you disagree about. And out of that, and you're going back and watching the tapes, looking at the ECGs, you know, all that sort of stuff, they realized that actually there's a science behind what makes couples happy and what makes couples very unhappy and everything in between. And it really was around how they respond when they disagree to something. So do you have to have the last word? Do you have to be right? It had nothing to do with how good they were at communicating or whether they yelled and screamed, which of course in many common popular marriage teachings, that's what we get taught, is how to communicate better or tone it down. But they actually found it was things like the other person felt you heard their point, whether you agreed with them or not. If they felt emotionally disconnected, they would rebond somehow, so affirm each other or their relationship. You know, when I studied this, I was probably married by then probably about seven, eight years. And, you know, I wasn't a perfect husband or father. I definitely don't want to give that illusion. But again, still being very intentional. So I'd come home from studying this research and have to write papers on it. And I'd say to my wife, this stuff's incredible. You know, we should do this. Let's practice some of these things. And that was a real turning. That was another turning point in my life, is just taking the science around how to build a healthy, close relationship and put it into practice, whether I felt like it or not. And Sue and I collectively, so we've actually never stopped. Right? So it's, again, we're nearly 38 years into our marriage. It's called now the Gottman Institute. They're on Facebook and all that stuff. So we're still print off there. They put up exercises to do as a couple. So just last week, I printed off one and Sue and I are doing it. You have to practice because it actually builds habits. That was sort of a moment in my marriage where I found the principles quite biblical. Like, there's nothing really, as a Bible teacher, there's nothing there that I would say is revelationary, but it's just another way of saying the same sort of thing. So you actually can build, it's not a luck of the draw. You build a relationship that lasts a lifetime. And Sue and I were, even before we got married, we didn't want to become what we nicknamed the dining dead. You know, when you go to a restaurant and there's an older couple sitting yes. near you and they never say a word to each other over the whole meal?
That's because they know telepathy.
Exactly right. Well, it's funny because, Sue and I wanted to stay emotionally close. And again, didn't know how we were going to do it, but we didn't want to become a couple that lived in the same house as we aged, but had nothing to talk about or didn't feel connected or close.
Yeah.
And we'd seen enough of those relationships in the broader culture and even within the church family we're in. And again, we didn't have the secret, but we sort of stumbled on practicing these principles of responding to your partner when they comment about something, always being nurturing, affirming your relationship. And so, but again, it's intentionality, right? You can have the information, but if you're not building it intentionally. So again, I don't say that with any sense of pride, just that I'm very grateful to God that my family relationship, my marriage is not a repeat of my family history and origin.
Yes.
And, you know, you can break it. You can actually stop the pain and the suffering. Don't pass it on to the next generation.
Yeah.
But you've got to take responsibility and be intentional and nurture each other to get there.
Just going back again to when you're like 19, 20 and you deliberately, off your own bat, reading about good and bad fathers.
Yeah.
Who can you name as you thought, he's a really bad father. Oh, and he's a really good father. Who comes to mind?
Well, there's so many bad ones, particularly in the Old Testament, right? It's, again, having now studied narrative criticism, so the whole thing about good guys, bad guys, you know, you see it in movies are structured the same way, yeah. right? Antagonist, protagonist. But you see that in biblical narrative, particularly in the Old Testament, where even some of the great, you know, heroes of faith that get mentioned in Hebrews, some of them were terrible fathers, right? They made very bad decisions. I mean, David wasn't a great father, King David. We look at the life of Samson. I mean, that's a cracker, that one. But again, it was more about me, as I was reading these stories that really reveal what not to do, is saying, okay, I have to submit myself to doing the right thing. And if I do the wrong thing, owning it, apologizing, you know, for instance, with, you know, when I was married and when as a father, if I had kids and I got upset with them unnecessarily, I would apologize and ask them to forgive me. I was that sort of a father, again, because I wanted to practice some of the things that I realized in the Bible stories. We have the warts and all versions, right? It's not a polished, let's remove the bad parts of that person's life story. We don't have that, which is great. It's warts and all. It's true in terms of, you know, you learn from good and bad. And most people, as we know ourselves, are a mixture of good and bad. We can both be very good and very nice and righteous, and we can also be very bad and mad and angry and do things we regret, say things we regret. So I sort of saw myself within those characters. I knew without anyone telling me that I was both of those sides of those people. You know, I could be good and bad.
Yeah, yeah. So we've heard about Samson and David being the bad fathers. Name a good father that we might not have thought of from the Bible as, oh, yeah, he is a good father.
I mean, some of the stories we have, like Jesse, so David's father, I think was pretty good. Even with some pretty arrogant sons, you know, some of David's older brothers. One passage that it's that stuck out to me then when I was probably 15 at the time is that Ephesians passage on, you know, from Ephesians 4:21 all the way down to Ephesians 6:10, which is really one teaching. It often gets chopped up. Submit one to another out of your reverence for Christ, and then, you know, wives submit to husbands, which of course has been preached, you know,
only occasionally.
Okay, yeah, let's say that of Martin. And by the way, often they leave out the verse before, submit one to another. So when I read that, I thought, whoa, hang on a minute. That sort of piqued my interest. I thought, I have to submit to my wife, which, you know, so again, people conveniently leave that off. But really, I learned through that passage has always stuck with me that Paul takes more time explaining to the man of that house. So it's like a house church in our language.
Yeah.
What? So the husband, father, owner of the slaves, it's the same man that really Paul's talking to. Paul takes more time explaining to the man what he has to do in loving his wife. And what we probably don't realize, you know, 2,000 years later, is that was revolutionary. So some theologians say before Paul wrote that, no one had ever told the men in those cultures, so, you know, in sort of Asia Minor or modern-day Turkey, that they had to love their wives. That was not part of their culture. So it was common for men to have either more than one wife or they would sleep in the local brothel and all that sort of stuff. We know from other historical documents that was common. But I think we've lost the radicalness of that teaching, that actually it's the man that has to lay down his life for his wife as Jesus laid down his life for the church. That's the sort of head that he has to be. That's the source of life that he has to be, like the head of a river. So again, sometimes that gets taught as authority, but I lean more on the use of the word in the original language as head of a river, or how Jesus became head of the church is that he died for it. And that's the radical. So that, you know, when I just would drink that in because I realized it was up to me to create the culture in the family that I wanted. It wasn't about me having the right or the power or being male. It was I had to be like Jesus, and his love for the church is to, you know, willingly put himself to death. And so that's quite radical, right? So that's probably, it's probably more so that teaching that's always resonated with me, and I've tried to live it out as faithfully as I can. Not, I haven't been perfect, but as faithfully as I can. I think that's a very radical teaching. And really, in fact, the rest of that, right up to Ephesians 6:10, it's all how we submit one to another within that family context historically. So that's why he says to fathers, don't exasperate your children. That's how a father submits to his children. So, yeah, that's one passage that I still reread today and digest today and try and live today as a husband, father, and now a grandfather.
It's fascinating you sharing this. My Daily Bread Bible notes that I use, we're currently going through Isaiah, and the person writing it really made a point I think could be deemed very controversial in churches today. And I'd love to know what you think, because the writer said that idols could in fact be your job and that you're putting your job first instead of your children. I'm slightly paraphrasing it, but that was basically it. I was going, oh, you can't say that in brackets. Yes, you flipping well can. Round of applause for the person. But I knew that if I said that, I'd get castigated because there's so many people who say, no, we're giving quality of life here. I need to go into work. My husband needs to go to work, or my wife needs to go to work, so we can give quality of life. There you go. Fingers on the buzzers, no conferring. What do you think?
I would agree. I totally agree with that. I think, you know, certainly in the ancient world, they had literal idols that were carved from wood or stone. But in the modern world, we, and again, speaking as a follower of Jesus myself, we can have idols. So I really, my definition of an idol is anything that takes the place of God in our life. So it can be work, it can be a relationship, it can be consumerism, it can be actually, you know, working for God, inverted commas. It can be a whole lot of things, because again, think of the way Jesus unpacked that topic about, and you really, unless you put him first. So, you know, you're willing to leave fathers, mothers, brothers. You know, we take the warm, fuzzy things that Jesus says, but some of the other stuff that he said, like, you know, I've come to separate some people, you know, families. If someone becomes a Christian, you know, they get rejected by their family. And so there definitely are things that can take the place of his role in our life where we're not really putting him first. And it can include your career, absolutely.
It begs the question then that if more Christians, instead of saying, well, I'm going to work because I want to, it's like, okay, what if you like sold your house and downsized, even though you've got two kids, you might have a very nice, which everyone would aspire to, a nice small detached house. If you could sell that and move to like a semi-detached house, one of you might be able to stay at home.
That's right.
Now, you know, I know that people have been castigated for even suggesting that in the past.
Yeah.
But what would you say on that tack for people listening today?
That's actually what my wife and I have just recently done. So we you know, we had a house that could fit our three children, and of course they're adults now, have moved out, obviously. And so we just 3 years ago, actually almost to the day, sold and downsized. I often wonder about some commands that Jesus said that we don't follow. Like we're quite by human nature, we take bits. So like when Jesus says to the rich young ruler, you know, sell everything you have, come follow me.
Mm.
How many people have done that? Actually, given away everything just to follow Jesus. You know, so we sort of make deals with God, unfortunately, about how much we're willing to give up.
Yes.
I'm suspicious even from, I'm talking about myself, that there are parts of my life that we keep God at arm's length. So he's not really Lord or master. I like the word master that Eugene Peterson uses in his translation. He's not really our master in every area. We're keeping at a certain safe distance sometimes. And it's usually a crisis that reveals that part of our life that we haven't given to him. And it's very uncomfortable, very painful at times when we realize we've kept God out of a certain pocket of our life. So, yeah, no, it's definitely something that I've experienced from time to time, giving up everything to follow Jesus. Because our Western culture is not very helpful to our Christianity. It tells us we have to plan ahead. We've got to be secure. You've got to have financial security. You've got to have a, you know, good career. You got to look after your family. And there's some truisms in those things. But of course, following Jesus is very different to living according to the culture we find ourselves in. In fact, I would argue all of the epistles in the New Testament we have because Paul's writing, Peter's writing, James's writing to Christians who are trying to follow Jesus in a culture that's different to theirs. And there are challenges to follow Jesus in a culture that doesn't celebrate the God that we know. And so that's why we actually have those writings. Without the cultural problems, we probably wouldn't have those writings. And so our culture is different today than theirs, absolutely. We have different issues. But following Jesus within a culture that doesn't celebrate our values and our God is always challenging. And culture just naturally seeps into Christianity, as it was when Paul wrote, for instance, to the church at Corinth, or the church in, you know, in Galatians as well, with going back to Judaism practices and stuff. So I don't think we're any different, Martin. I think we just don't recognize how affected by our culture we can be as Christians.
Well, to sum that up before we move to the next subject, I think Tony Campolo, the great Tony Campolo, well, I think he's great anyway, eloquently said, and I'm paraphrasing this, that basically the Bible got it wrong. You know, it doesn't say, I surrender all. What it should have said was, I surrender 10%.
He's a great preacher, wasn't he? He was fantastic.
Stunning. Absolutely. Yeah. I had the privilege of meeting him a couple of times. An amazing person. Now that in your job with Alpha Australia as a project development manager, what have you seen about the youth of today in Australia that A, encourages you, and B, oh, I don't know so much?
Look, it's a very interesting question. I was recently at an inter-church council meeting and I was asked, does Youth Alpha work? Which is very, it always makes me smile inside. You know, I have to maintain a bit of dignity, but it's like saying, does God still lead people into his kingdom? Alpha really just joins a conversation God's already having with someone. So whether they're aware of it or not, I think God's more interested and passionate about evangelism, evangelization than we could ever be, no matter how passionate we are. I mean, Jesus died on the cross and rose again. So what I notice with young people, I think it's actually a bit more global, Martin, than just even in Australia, is they are very open and want to talk about spirituality and even Christianity. What's interesting is having worked, you know, being involved with Alpha probably for 12 years, Both as someone that helps churches start Alpha, and also I look after the marriage course in Australia. And also being involved in church leadership, church planting, is I think for our generation, people had some Christian heritage or some knowledge. So in the broader culture, even those that maybe didn't have a relationship with God, they had a family member that went to church, or as a child, you know, mum or dad would drag them to church as a kid, but they didn't continue or develop their own relationship with God. And so then if we ask them, would they like to come to Alpha? Would they like to come to, you know, a men's breakfast at church? Because of that residual sort of history that sometimes was negative or painful for them,
yes,
they'd have a go at us, you know, or they'd make fun of us. Oh, you go to church, or, you know, if I went to church, the roof would cave in, I'm such a sinner, or they even tell you to get stuffed, or, you know, or what, and everything in between, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But what's interesting is, particularly for Gen Z, the research globally, so that the people who are 24 and under, to, you know, probably till about 14, they're actually really interested. So the Christians within that age group, it's natural. They want to tell their friends about Jesus. They don't have the barriers or the bad stories of being rejected that we have.
Okay.
So their friends in their age group actually want to know. That's the, so there's two sides of the same coin. So the Christians who are 24 and under want to share their faith with their friends. They're not shy. There's no bad history here. There's no knowledge at all with their friends about Christianity. And their non-Christian friends at home have this knowledge. Research in a number of countries shows those non-Christian Gen Z and Gen Alpha, they're not asking, was Jesus real? So did he really live? Which was probably our generation's question, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
The historical Jesus, all that sort of stuff that came out in the 60s and 70s and 80s. Their question is, was Jesus good? So just think about that for a moment. So 24 and under are not saying, did Jesus really live? They just say, well, how good was this guy really? So I think we're on the precipice of an incredible opportunity and possible harvest, because older people don't realize that young people are very interested and want to have a conversation. The other thing is they want authentic, genuine people to model it.
Yeah.
So, you know, that old adage, you know, you got to practice what you preach. That's very true with Gen Z. They're not looking for the sort of big event type church anymore, you know, where, you know, a lot of lights and music and that sort of, that era sort of slowly died out. What Gen Z are looking for, or authentic, if you really say that you know Jesus and you follow him, they have to see it in your life. And through that genuine, authentic modeling, they will ask you questions, and they, it's a genuine interest. So it's, I think things have changed actually, really, since COVID. I think things have changed for young people. And that's the research that we read at Alpha Australia that comes out of England, the US, Canada, as well as our own country. They're all saying the same thing. Gen Z want to know, was Jesus good? And they're quite keen to have that conversation, because there's no bad history between them and the church or Christianity. They literally have no idea, and they're very interested. So that's incredible, right, when you just think about that. So sometimes it's how we use our language. So, you know, if we're trying to preach or convert somebody, I think that doesn't help. It's really just doing more listening, and that's one of the things that Alpha really, the Alpha culture that I think's made it go global, is the fact we put more focus on listening to our non-Christian guests than telling them things. And research says the more you listen to someone, the more they like you. It's not actually the more you talk or the more you say or the more you tell them about what you think or who you are. Psychologists tell us this: people feel loved the more you listen to them.
Yeah.
Again, think, you know, in recent history with the focus on apologetics, which is still needed. I'm not definitely not, you know, throwing stones at apologetics. But what Alpha is more of a listening way of allowing a non-Christian explore not just what they believe, but why they believe it and how they feel about their belief. And the only way you can do that is for the Christian leading an Alpha group is to do the least amount of talking and just keep asking them open-ended questions. And really, God does the rest. The person is really having a conversation with God. You take those two things, that Gen, you know, 24 and under are very interested, but it's how we have those conversations, I think, is the other part of that coin.
If I was able to organise all the main church leaders in Australia, let's say, they're all in a massive big Enormo dome, they're all there from 10 people going to church to thousands going to the church, and I wheel you on to say, right, you've got 2 minutes to say to them how they can get the kids of today who are asking these questions into a church on a Sunday, what would you say to them? And what would you say also about the services that you're doing? Does it have to be on a Sunday, for instance? What would you say?
That's a great question. I think, and this is from my experience in my own local church, in which I'm one of the leaders there, I would empower the young people in their church to actually reach the young people in their circle of friends. I think part of this problem that I think unintentionally that we've sort of developed is if the vicar or priest or minister, pastor has to do it all, really ministry is the body at work, so everyone engaged. Often we only reach our own demographic. I don't think we talk about this enough. So, you know, I can reach people my age group because I have the same interests, I'm in the same life stage, have similar stories, you know, grew up in the same time period, you know, like with punk music, for example. You know, reaching someone who's, you know, 16, you know, as a 59-year-old, I'm probably not going to be as good as that. And I think we need to be a bit more honest, number one, about that. But also then the young people I do have in a church family, how do I empower them? How do I either give them tools or resource them? So you're right, that group does not have to gather on a Sunday. So again, with my alpha brain, if you like, as in the alpha course, is it's like running alpha. You do it at a place that's the most comfortable for those who don't normally come to church. So, I know alphas run in churches, but of course alphas run in pubs, prisons. It's run for homeless people, you know, under bridges or in homeless shelters. It's run in gyms, sports bars, not because we're just trying to get it out of the church. That's not the point. Is an unchurched person doesn't normally come to church. So why would they come to church for alpha?
Yeah.
So the bigger question is, where are those people having conversations about, is there more to life than this? You know, is there a spiritual dimension? Am I just here to pay the bills, maybe have some kids and then die? Is that really the point of life? People who are not Christians normally have those conversations with their friends in a cafe. So why not do something in a cafe, whether it's alpha or some other resource, and have an open conversation where you're not traditionally preaching at them, and do more listening. And eventually they ask you, well, why do you think what you think? You know, and then you can share your life experience, like I share my life experience. But you have to earn the empathy, you know, and the right to have those conversations. But give it to young people to do. They'll reach their own generation if we equip them and give them permission, champion them, mentor them. You can certainly coach them, but don't go to those gatherings. Let them do it their way. I think partly we're the fruit of the same principle, right? Our generation reached us their way. I'm a champion of young people doing ministry, whether it's in the workplace, in a sporting facility, in a club, wherever they want to do it.
Yeah.
When people, particularly church leaders, will say things like, you know, young people are the next leaders. If I know them well, I'll gently say, actually, I think they're leading now. If you think they're the next leaders, you're a bit late. Just look at the global movements, Me Too, the Green Movement. They're all led by young adults.
Mm.
You know, so I think us older guys have to, and women have to realize young people are leading in the broader culture. You know, maybe in the church, we're just a bit slower.
So maybe they could actually run the Alpha course as well, because it's all there, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's exactly what happened in my church. I had a young guy, started a basketball team with all his non-Christian friends.
Wow.
He'd never actually done alpha himself, but he said, oh, do you think I could run alpha with my friends? I said, sure. I just coached him a little bit, told him how it worked, got it onto his iPad, and he ran it with his team after training.
Wow.
And a couple of people came to Jesus. So again, God is there, right?
Yeah.
To answer your question, I would empower young people to do ministry wherever they are, and don't make them conform to our structures, because they're a different generation.
All I can say is I think you're doing yourself a bit of a disservice, really, because you say you're an older guy. How can you relate to younger guys? You could actually wear your AC/DC t-shirt together with like a 17, 18-year-old, and you could say, yeah, but I saw them the first time around when, you know, they were 17 or 18 sort of thing.
That's right, yeah. Yes. AC/DC, they filmed their first film clip here in Melbourne, actually. If you ever watch It's a Long Way to the Top, on YouTube. It's one of the main streets here in Melbourne. They're on the back of a truck, just slowly going down the main street.
Wow. Well, I unfortunately lent my book by their first ever roadie, who later became a pastor.
Yeah, that's right.
I can't get it back because it was phenomenal. You know, and I believe the guys in AC/DC, Mr. Young and co, were thinking, wow, we'll sell the book on their, you know, their world tours and stuff like that, because they were really proud of what he had achieved from being a roadie to then becoming a pastor.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Incredible.
It's been an amazing time as well listening to this. And I just got one more question to ask you, if that's all right, young Greg. So, Greg Murray, all the way from Melbourne, Australia, live via the interweb. Who is your Christian hero, please?
I would say Eugene Peterson. I first discovered Eugene, I was probably in my mid-20s. I was director of Youth for Christ here in Melbourne, and I read a book called Working the Angles. And that really ministered to me because it challenged my expression of Christianity that I've lived in, sort of the Pentecostal charismatic world, about going deeper with God and how our relationship with God is more important than what we do for God. So I remember one quote that has stuck with me. It's a bit tongue-in-cheek, I think. I mean, Eugene's known for the Message translation, but he's actually written many books towards particularly pastors, people doing the work of ministry to really speak into that world. One of my favorite quotes, he says, "The problem with churches is that they're full of sinners. And worse still, their pastor is also a sinner," which just tickled my fancy, right? I got a real sort of funny sense of humor. I just thought, that's gold. I can relate to that myself.
Yeah.
And you know how we, you know, as Christian leaders, he's got this, he co-wrote another book, which I've just finished rereading for the third time, The Unnecessary Pastor, and how unknowingly our culture has told us how as leaders or pastors, we think we're so necessary for the congregation and for God to use us. And him and this other author, Marva, they just unpick that sort of saying, actually we're not necessary to what our congregation demands. Well, we're not necessary in what culture tells us we should be. We're actually quite unnecessary, you know. So it just is, I just like the way that he challenges some of my echo chamber Christianity that I sit in, to think a little bit broader and deeper about particularly my own relationship with God and how to, you know, I'm just a disciple first and foremost. I'm not a pastor or a project manager at Alpha. I think another phrase he's got is there's no experts in the discipleship of Jesus. We're all just followers. Mm. And I just like that tone. Yeah, it's really helped me.
And very quickly, because he died a couple of years ago, I think that was all.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, that's correct.
What do you know about him, where he lived and everything else?
So he lived in Oregon in the US and originally planted a church in New York City. Eventually, when he went to Oregon, he led the one church, I think, for 29 years. I think it was called Christ the King. It was like a Presbyterian church, mm-hmm. effectively. But he had a very Pentecostal mother, which has always been a funny story. She used to, as you know, like a seven-year-old, she would drive up into the wood-cutting hills of Oregon on her own, you know, in a snow blizzard to preach to all the timber cutters.
Wow.
So she was the only woman, yeah. If you just ever read, you know, or anyone else listening, read his life story, the influences on his life where, you know, his dad was a butcher who was the only butcher in town. And his mum was a full-on Pentecostal, you know, would go out and preach to these rough timber cutters, you know, in the 1930s. So can you just imagine? He would go with his mum, get them all to sing hymns and they're all spitting out the window and, you know, then she'd preach at them and pray with them and drive home, you know, down the mountain. So, yeah, but just again, the way he helps those who in Christian leadership in particular just to reground ourselves that we're all just following Jesus. We're all sojourners. His writings have really ministered to me personally. And so I still reread his books. But yeah, he did pass away about 3-4 years ago now.
Cracking choice. Unfortunately, he's been chosen before, but not often. So, you know, you're in prestigious company there as well. Greg Murray, thank you so much for joining us this evening, or this early morning for you. I can now see that the sun has come up and has come through the windows.
The sun has come up. I'm about to go to work. That's correct.
Greg, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an absolute privilege. I really appreciate your time. Thank you. God bless.
Thank you, Martin.
Next time on Off-Grid Christianity.
I think that's what people are looking for. They're looking for a homecoming. They're looking for what home looks like. I confused the house with home for many, many years. I was a million net worth guy. I lived on a golf course, but I was a stranger in my own home. I was a stranger in my own marriage. And that's what trauma does. It isolates you from yourself and it divorces you from you. And so it's very difficult to be married to somebody like that because you're not emotionally available. You're not present. And I was trying desperately to find what home was, and I couldn't find it. It took me a half a decade to figure out it's not a building.
So please join me with our special guest, Kevin DeVries, next time for a special two-parter here on Off-Grid Christianity. Cheerio.